Hi, this is John with a few very quick announcements. First, an update on the Mormon Stories fundraising campaign, since a few of you have asked about it. I'm a little over halfway where we need to be in monthly subscribers to be able to continue Mormon Stories at its current level past July 2010. So let me both thank all of you who have signed up as a monthly subscriber and encourage any of you who haven't yet to please consider doing so. All donations are tax deductible and will go directly to the time and materials used to produce the podcast. Second, registration for the two Sunstone workshops I'm holding on August 4th is now up. The morning session is entitled How to Navigate an LDS Faith Crisis In or Out of the Church, and the afternoon session is entitled How to Navigate a Marriage When One of You Loses Their Testimony. Hopefully some couples will be able to attend that. All the information you need to register can be found at mormonstories.org. I hear that registration is filling up fast, so please register soon if that's something you want to attend. Third, I've decided to record the entire workshop and make the proceedings available to all Mormon Stories monthly subscribers as a thank you for your support. So I'm hoping that might encourage a few more of you to support Mormon Stories if you are able, again at mormonstories.org. And finally, if any of you are interested in joining the Mormon Stories private internet forum to converse with other like-minded Mormons, please send me an email via Facebook and I'll make sure you get added. Whew, that was a lot of announcements. Thanks for your patience. And now on with the show. Hello and welcome to another edition of Mormon Stories Podcast. My name is John DeLynn. I am very excited to have you with us today. And today I have as my special guest a man whom I've been associated with, or at least aware of, for, I don't know, at least 10 years. Richard Packham. Richard Packham, thanks for joining us today on Mormon Stories.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for inviting me, John.
Again, it's my pleasure. Okay, so today we're dealing with some topics that are going to be very, very sensitive to a lot of people on all sides of the faith spectrum. And if it's okay, I'd just like to give maybe a brief framing or introduction. Today, we're going to be talking about, at a very high level, is the way I'd like to frame it, how the LDS Church and the church culture creates enemies for itself. It seems like a very sensitive topic, but I think it's important, and I'll give it this framing. When I was growing up in the church with kind of an orthodox, almost fundamentalist understanding of Mormonism, that I got from seminary and institute, not necessarily from my parents. I would read about how the Mormons were treated in Ohio and in Illinois and in Missouri. And it never added up to me. What I heard was Mormons were punished and driven out and persecuted because they were doing God's will, and Satan always opposes God's will. And that was the framing. And on the one hand, I believed it, but on the other hand, intellectually, it didn't quite make sense. It didn't make sense for the level of opposition, the level of anger, the level of hatred that was levied against us. It just seemed a little bit excessive, you know, burning our cities and killing our people and kicking us out of entire states. Then I once read an explanation by Leonard Arrington, I believe, who talked about things that the Mormons did, especially in Missouri, that led to the persecution. And it talked about how we sort of swooped in all at once, you know, for people who had lived there many, many years, claimed that we were God's chosen people, started buying up all the land, started influencing the political vote, started manipulating the political vote, doing things religiously where we would sort of openly assert that other religions were false and evil. Economic things we did in terms of growing too fast politically and economically, all sorts of things that we did to create enemies. And it's not, you know, this piece that I read wasn't created with the intent to blame the church for the violence that was perpetrated against it. Violence, I guess, is never excusable, or let's just say it's rarely excusable. But what it did is it rounded out my understanding to give me a little more context
to just sort of not frame it as Boggs and the Missourians were evil and controlled by Satan, and the Mormons were these innocent people doing God's will. It was much more complex than that. And frankly, I think it's healthy for any group to understand their enemies, because if they can if they can take action that doesn't hurt their people, doesn't hurt their system, but at the same time doesn't unnecessarily create enemies, then I think that's a win-win for everybody. And this was sort of struck again to mind just recently as the University of Utah has been invited into the Pac-10 Athletic Conference, and BYU was sort of left out of that picture. And I read some journalist who wrote that it was bigotry, plain and simple, religious bigotry that caused BYU to be left out of the Pac-10 invitation. And I think that just is a modern example of this sort of uninformed, unaware paranoia, where we don't really understand sometimes as a church and as a culture what we're doing and why we're creating enemies. And if we had a little better understanding, maybe we would do things to keep from creating those enemies. So in that spirit, I've invited Richard Packham to be on this podcast. And I was sensitive to Richard even before we started, because I don't know if Richard would feel comfortable being framed as either an enemy of the church or as an anti-Mormon. And Richard, we're going to get into that, so I don't feel like you need to respond to that now. But
all right.
Fine. But I'm sensitive to the fact that is very offensive to sort of frame it that way and then bring you on. What I will say is this: I first discovered Richard Packham, I'm going to say around 2000-2001, as I went through my own faith crisis. I jumped up on the internet, and I was looking for people who discussed Mormonism openly. And this is before the Bloggernacle. This was before the Farron Farms really had anything of substance up. And I found the works of Richard Packham. And Richard Packham is no longer a member of the LDS Church. And what's remarkable about Richard Packham is that even though today there are thousands of people every year leaving the church, he did this back in 1958 when he was 25 years old. I think it's a lot easier to leave the church now than it was back then, because the information that we have now wasn't readily available back then. And the social consequences of leaving the church, I think, were much more severe back then than they are now. And so Richard put up a website many, many, many years ago discussing why he left the church and trying to explain it. And I would say that his website sort of proactively seeks to inform people about, you know, his view on what Mormonism is really about, and maybe even to warn potential investigators that they need to get more information and to really think things through before they need to join. So I have a theory. You know, I say this probably every podcast. I'm sure my listeners are tired of hearing it, but I've probably spoken with over 1,000 people who are either struggling with or have left the church. They've emailed me, we've had phone calls, they've come to have lunch with me, all over the world. And as I've tried to think about what would make someone put up a website against the church, what would make someone create an organization or a conference dedicated to, leaving the church? What would make someone talk about the temple ceremony openly, or, you know, whatever? Why, you know, there's this cliche, they can leave the church, but they can't leave it alone. And I used to love that phrase. Now I find it repugnant, even though I am active in the church and I love the church. But it shows a fundamental unwillingness to empathize with and understand why these people leave. I think these people leave for very understandable reasons. And I have a theory that there are at least three major ways in which the church and its culture creates enemies. The first is in the way that it deals with its history, the fact that it's not candid and proactively honest about its own history. Accompanied with that is not just how it deals with its own members, but also how it deals in the missionary effort. The second major pillar of how we create enemies is when we tear apart families over religious issues, and specifically when a non-believing spouse loses their believing spouse and children as a result of, the way the church operates in the lives of its people. And then the final pillar of my thesis is that when non-believers see the church do damage to the lives of their believing loved ones, the combination of those three things would incite anyone to sort of use words like cult, to put up websites that are with the express purpose of hurting the church, and doing all they can till their dying day to bring the church down. So with that framing, Richard Packham, let's start with your story. And I want to start by the positive. I want to hear, in 5 minutes, all the wonderful things about the church and your experience with the church before you started questioning it.
Well, my experience with the church until I finally left it was really very good. I had a very wonderful Mormon childhood, descended from four, five, six generations of Mormon ancestors. My parents were very loving, devout Mormons. I enjoyed generally going to church. I obeyed the commandments. I kept the word of wisdom. I did everything that a good Mormon boy or a Mormon young man was supposed to do. I advanced in the priesthood. I married a devout Mormon girl from a good Mormon family, and we began to raise our children as Mormons. I enjoyed, especially, my callings were almost always in the music end of things because I had some musical talent. So I was always the chorister or the organist, and I enjoyed the good old Mormon hymns. I was enthusiastic about knowing the truth and spreading the gospel. At the time when I was mission age, a lot of people don't understand how much the church has changed in the last 50 years. When I was mission age, it was really not all that common for young men my age to go on missions. Some did, but there were a great many who did not. And it was kind of up to the young man whether he wanted to spend some time on a mission or whether he had other things to do. And my primary goal at that point in my life was to get my education. And so it was perfectly okay for me not to go on a mission. So I never served a mission. I understand that I have something in common with President Monson, who also never served a mission.
I didn't know that.
Well, it's come up several times in discussion on ex-Mormon discussion boards. Hey, how can Monson be president of the church? He never served a mission. So I always try to step in and say, look, in those days, it wasn't expected of every young man to serve a mission.
Interesting.
So anyway.
Interesting.
So,
you're in good company.
Right, I guess so. Except I don't have visions like President Monson is supposed to have.
Right.
So anyway, my church experience was almost always very pleasant, and I also got very good strokes because from Mormon leaders because I was such a good Mormon boy. And it wasn't until I began to try to And as a matter of fact, what got me out of the church was my attempts to be an even better Mormon.
Right.
And that is to spread the gospel among my non-Mormon friends. It was when I went away to graduate school with my Mormon wife and kids in tow that I was first exposed to a large community of very intellectual, non-Mormon people.
Right.
And this was when I was in graduate school in Illinois at the Northwestern University. And I felt that this would give me an opportunity to be a missionary in my own way, and that is to spread the gospel among my non-believing colleagues, fellow students, and even my professors. And I even did approach several of my professors to explain Mormonism to them, and they were all very kind, and they listened gently, and probably shook their heads after I left. But I felt that I was doing what the Lord wanted me to do.
Right.
Some of my fellow students, however, were very well versed in their own religious beliefs. They were good Lutherans or Catholics or Baptists, and they would ask me quite probing questions that I didn't know the answer to. And so I felt that I owed it to myself and to God to study out the answers to these questions so that I could show these other non-Mormons that the gospel was indeed true. I was fortunate to be at Northwestern because the university there had an excellent library, the Deering Library, which had a large collection of materials on Mormonism, probably because Illinois, in the history of Illinois, the Mormons played a rather large role in the mid-19th century.
Right.
So I began, I was amazed to find so much material on Mormonism. And so I began trying to figure out the answers to these questions. I mean, they asked me, what about some of the questions were, you know, what about these Danite exterminator gangs that the Mormons had in Missouri? And what about this teaching that Adam is God? And other things like that. And I'd never heard about most of these things.
Right.
And I thought, well, this has to be lies. You know, these are people that are telling lies about Mormonism because we don't believe that Adam is God. So I started doing research, and I found some troubling things, but it didn't really affect my faith. I realized that all I had to do was keep prayerfully searching, and eventually the answers would come. It was about 3 years later that, after all the research, but in the meantime, we'd lived in Utah for a couple of years while I had a teaching job there in Ogden, and I'd gone on to Johns Hopkins University to do more graduate research there. And it was finally at Johns Hopkins, when I was still struggling with these problems, that it occurred to me that all of the problems disappeared once I admitted to myself that the church was just another man-made religion.
Right.
And it was like a revelation to me. I didn't necessarily think it was a revelation from God, but it was like an epiphany. And I remember running home and telling my wife with joy and happiness, "Guess what, darling? The church isn't true." And that was the beginning of the end for our marriage, because she didn't want to hear anything about it. And I realized at that point that I had made some serious mistakes in my relationship with my wife, because I hadn't been telling her about my work trying to prove that the church was true and defend it against its detractors, because I didn't want to upset her.
Right.
And of course, I ended up really upsetting her when I realized, when I told her about the conclusion that I had come to.
So do you feel like that was just a big shock to her? Did she have just, did she blindside her?
Yes, that was a big shock to her because she had no suspicion at all that I was having any doubts or questions. Well, and which of course was accurate because until that moment in the library, I had no doubts.
Right.
I had lots of questions, but I didn't have any doubts. I continued to be to assure myself that I would be able to erase all of these doubts if I just found the right answers.
So here's where it makes sense to sort of throw in some of the stereotypes. And some of the stereotypes are, number one, you know, you stopped reading the scriptures and stopped praying and, you know, stop being committed to the church. Do you feel like that applied to you?
Well, I suppose I have to admit that I really did stop praying because I'd never really had all that much good results and as a result of my prayers. I viewed it as I viewed the gospel intellectually and emotionally as well. You know, it was my culture. I loved it. I had good feelings about it, but I was I guess I took too literally the Mormon doctrine that the glory of God is intelligence and that the gospel is rational.
Uh-huh.
And any reasonable person who examines the gospel will conclude rationally that it is indeed the truth.
Right.
So perhaps that was a mistake I made.
Well, I don't ask this question thinking, and I know you wouldn't worry about this, but I don't ask this question thinking you have anything to be ashamed of. There are plenty of active Mormons who fall behind on their prayer and scripture study. But some of those people do so because they don't find that prayer works the way that they're kind of led to expect that it's going to work. Does that make sense?
Yes.
And they don't find fulfillment in the scriptures, some people. And and so they just kind of hanging on their own hats that they're slackers, but in reality, the way they're taught to pray and the way they're taught to read the scriptures just isn't edifying. But
well,
what was it for you?
Well, as far as the scriptures go, I did continue to read the scriptures because I felt that probably there was part of the answer, and I accepted the scriptures as the word of God, but it was in my scripture reading that I began to have some problems because, for example, I read the book of Ecclesiastes. And in reading Ecclesiastes, you find all kinds of things that not only call into question Mormonism, but also some fundamental Christian ideas, like the idea that, well, you know, when you die, that's it. You know, you just turn to dust. And what is there after you die? There's nothing after you die. And
that's what Ecclesiastes says?
Yeah, yes, right, yeah. I recommend to people that are having that rely on their scriptures, I says, read the book of Ecclesiastes because it does not fit in well with basic Christian or Mormon beliefs. And then another passage I came across in Hosea, or no, I'm sorry, in, is it Hosea or Micah? One of them,
Old Testament.
Is Micah.
Old Testament.
Micah, Old Testament.
Okay.
Yeah, where the prophet says, "God hath shown thee, O man, what is good, and what doth God require of you, but to deal justly with thy fellow man, and walk humbly with thy God."
Right.
That's all God wants,
right,
is for you to you know, deal justly and love your fellow man, I think it was. And I thought, well, gee, what then, what about baptism? What, doesn't God want you to be baptized? Doesn't
Right.
God want you to go to the temple and get your endowment? Doesn't God want you to preach the gospel? I mean, does God really require you to pay tithing if all you're supposed to do is
walk
humbly with thy God and deal justly with thy fellow man? And that really raised a question for me. And people, I think the church really makes a mistake if it wants to keep people in the church in encouraging them to read the scriptures, because reading the Book of Mormon raises a lot of questions, or reading the Doctrine and Covenants. I know people who've left the church after they have read the Doctrine and Covenants from cover to cover.
Right.
And the Book of Mormon raises a lot of questions, because it's supposed to be the fullness of the gospel, and yet there are major principles and practices of present-day Mormonism that are not even mentioned in the Book of Mormon, and as when it comes to polygamy, even condemned in the Book of Mormon.
Right.
There's the passage in the Book of Mormon where Jesus is supposedly told the Nephites, look, this is my doctrine, faith, repentance, and baptism, and that's it. That's my doctrine. And anybody that says that there's more to my doctrine than that is of the devil.
Right.
Yeah. Well, then where does the temple endowment come in?
Right.
Where does all of the rest of it come in?
And that's an important point to make. And this was my experience. I stumbled on your stuff as I was trying to be a more effective seminary teacher, specifically trying to teach Doctrine and Covenants and church history, wanting to dig deeper to be a more effective teacher. So this stereotype that people are weak or feeble or faithless, and that's what leads them out of the church, probably isn't accurate. How would you frame it?
I think that's correct. Now, we do have to admit that I do know of a lot of people who have gone inactive and dropped out, who were just lazy and shiftless and decided they didn't want to have anything to do with it. I think those were really not Mormons in the first place.
And they rarely become anti-Mormons in my experience.
Oh, yeah, that's correct. Yeah, they rarely do.
They don't bother to put up a website and fight the church. They just, go do other stuff.
That's true.
Okay, what about the stereotype that you just were looking for an excuse to justify a sin or to begin committing sin?
I think that's rare among ex-Mormons.
What about for your experience? What about your experience for you and your journey?
Oh, all right. No, I had no desire to sin.
Like, or you wanted to drink, or you wanted to look at porn, or you didn't want to pay tithing.
Right. It wasn't until after I left the church that I thought, well, gee, what is this thing about wine or beer or coffee? I had never wanted to be unfaithful to my wife. I never had. As long as we were married and as long as I was in the church, and even for some time after I left the church, I never had any desire or extramarital thoughts at all.
Right.
I was 100%, now I will admit that once I'd left the church and once I was divorced from my wife and once I was out there in the world and needed to find my place and maybe find another companion, then I became sexually active.
Sure.
Right. And then I began to experiment with wine, but that wasn't my motivation for leaving at all.
Right. Okay. That makes sense. So you find these troubling historical things and these issues with the scriptures. And this is going to be an obvious question, but I need you to be explicit. Mm-hmm. What does that have to do with you leaving the church? Why did you feel like you needed to leave the church?
It was an act of intellectual honesty, I suppose.
How so?
I suppose it was. I couldn't continue to say that something was true when I didn't believe it was true.
Right.
I remember specifically. I kept going to church with my wife and kids. This was in Baltimore, a very small ward. I think there was one ward in Baltimore at the time. And I continued to go to church. And then I remember one day the bishop asked me to give the closing prayer. This was after I decided that the church wasn't true. And I had to tell him. I said, "Bishop, I don't think that I want to give the closing prayer because I don't believe it's true. I just don't go along with that anymore." So
wasn't that hard? I mean, I don't mean to sort of overly be too effusive and praiseful, but there's a perspective that says that's a very courageous thing to do, because there's a lot of people who have doubts who would be ashamed to admit it and who would never want to admit it publicly and who just kind of keep to themselves. It's a totally different thing to say, "Look, I'm struggling, and Bishop, I'm going to admit to you that I'm struggling." Especially back in the early 1960s or mid 1960s or late 1950s.
Yeah.
Was that hard to do?
I don't recall how I felt about it, but I felt that I had to say I don't think that I'm going to want to pray. I was fortunate in that I was not ever asked to teach. There were a number of times I was asked to talk in church, and as long as I believed it, I gave wonderful talks that people felt were inspiring. I never had a chance to refuse to give a talk because I wasn't asked after I had decided that the church wasn't true.
Right.
But you know, there was something else I was going to say. I guess it's that I try to be honest with myself. I can't pretend to myself, or I can't act in a certain way generally if my emotions don't match that, if my feelings don't match that. I mean, I can tell a little white lie to somebody on a social level, you know, without hurting, in order to avoid hurting their feelings. But when it comes to basic beliefs, I can't tell myself that I believe something when I really don't.
Right. And so your leaving the church was an act of it began with the motivation of truth seeking, and it ended with a commitment to integrity and honesty.
Well, that sounds pretty good, yeah.
Now, I don't mean to frame it that way, but it's just so different than how an active believing LDS would see someone who leaves the church. But that's how, after interviewing 1,000 people, that's how I've often seen the pattern emerge.
Well, and I think that's accurate. I think a lot of people struggle with it maybe more than I did, and resist admitting to themselves that they don't believe it anymore. And they go on trying to act as though they do believe it because they fear the consequences of admitting to themselves that they don't believe it anymore. And those people are generally, and I've talked to a lot of them informally and know some of them, and they generally go through a period of extreme torment. And I guess that's an example of what is called cognitive dissonance.
Right. Did you ever try to talk to a ecclesiastical leader, or you know, general authorities, or did you ever try and like grapple with your learnings of the history, with how the history is portrayed in the church, you know, while you were a member?
I don't recall having any conversations on the local level. I did think that probably if I asked one of the general authorities, I would get a straight answer. And so I did write to Joseph Fielding Smith, who at the time was president of the Quorum of the Twelve and also church historian. And he was a man that at the time I admired very greatly. And I thought, you know, President Smith will be honest with me. And so I wrote to him about my problem with the Adam God thing, because my research had demonstrated to me that Brigham Young did indeed teach that Adam was God, and that
God the Father,
and that he was the only God with whom we had to deal.
Right.
And I also at the same time recalled a strange conversation that I had with Sidney B. Sperry when I was a student at Brigham Young University, and a bunch of us after class were standing around talking about deep doctrine, and Professor Sperry made a comment that stuck with me. He said, you know, brethren, one of these days when we finally get to see God, I think you may be surprised at who it really is. And I thought, wow. Mm. And of course, later when I had found out about Brigham Young's teachings of the Adam God, I thought, you know, that's probably what Professor Sperry was talking about. And so I wrote to Joseph Fielding Smith and explained to him what my research had told me, and asked him to please clarify it for me, that I was perfectly willing at the time to accept Brigham Young's teaching that Adam was indeed God, and that it was probably a very sacred and secret teaching that we probably shouldn't be talking about openly in the church, but, you know, it probably was true. I mean, Brigham Young was a prophet, after all. Mm. And so I wrote in that tone to President Smith, and I sort of expected him to write back to me and say, yes, Brother Packham, you've stumbled on something that is a precious doctrine, and treat it the way you say, do your temple vows, and don't talk about it openly, but it is a precious truth, and you're to be commended for having the spiritual fortitude to discover it, etc. But that wasn't what he wrote at all. It was a very brief letter, and it told me that such a doctrine was false, it was ridiculous, it was non-scriptural, and anybody who believed it would go to hell. Mm. And he said nothing about Brigham Young, or tried at all to explain why it appeared that Brigham Young taught that. And I was just dumbfounded. Mm-hmm. And could only conclude that President Smith, who was the church historian, didn't know his church history, or he was lying to me.
Right.
Although I didn't actually verbalize that, it was disturbing enough to me that I think that was one of the nails in the coffin of my membership.
Did you uncover, prior to your leaving the church, any of the other standard issues, such as the temple ceremony, Mason connections of the pre-1990 temple ceremony, the Book of Abraham and the papyrus stuff, the polyandry with Joseph, blacks in the priesthood, and the racist statements made by Brigham Young, any of the Book of Mormon anachronisms? Did any of those things, or was it just Adam God?
No, there were some other things. But it's interesting that on that list of things you mentioned, some of those weren't even available at the time.
Right.
Like the Book of Abraham papyrus,
right.
they hadn't been discovered yet. And as far as the Book of Mormon went, when I left the church, when I decided that the church was not what it claimed to be, the Book of Mormon was still a puzzle to me. I could not explain the Book of Mormon as being just a man-made thing. It was a puzzle for me. And even though I had read the Book of Mormon very carefully, and I'd taken Book of Mormon classes from Sidney Sperry, the Book of Mormon played no role in my leaving the church. As a matter of fact, If anything, it would have been a stumbling block, because I still found it quite amazing and remarkable that Joseph Smith could have produced something like that.
So in other words, to leave the church, you had to crawl around, over, or under the Book of Mormon. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, that's exactly what I did. And I think that the apostle, who was it? Was it Hammond? Or?
It was Elder Holt.
Nelson, one of them.
It was Elder Holt. I was just saying that.
He must have had me in mind, because I did crawl over and around the Book of Mormon. Of course, since then, there's been so much information made available about the Book of Mormon that nobody has to crawl over it. I mean, you just blow it away with a puff of smoke and you're out of the church.
Well, there's a lot of people who still have very strong spiritual or emotional ties to the Book of Mormon.
Yes, I understand. I understand that. Some of the other things, I knew that Joseph Smith was a polygamist at the time I left the church, and that made perfect sense. I mean, polygamy was one of the doctrines of the church, and someday we were going to practice it again. Although, if that had ever occurred, my mother would have left the church, even though she was a devout Mormon. She told us a number of times, if they ever bring back polygamy, I'm out of the church. Mm. And yet she ended her days as a devout Mormon temple worker.
Right.
So I knew about that. I didn't know about the polyandry. There were some other troubling issues. I didn't know about, well, of course, and I realized the racism, because when I left the church still denied priesthood to the blacks.
Right.
I didn't see that as a problem at all. Not that I was racist or anything, but, you know, if the church wants to keep the blacks from going to the temple or getting married in the temple, that seemed to me okay. It didn't strike me as being something that was characteristic of the church of the Church of Christ, but that wasn't one of the reasons that I left. Other disturbing things that I uncovered was some other examples of the church lying, or church officials lying. I found among some of my grandfather's papers, who he had served a mission in England about 1910, and among his papers was the reprint of a tract that included a transcription of a conversation that John Taylor had had with some Protestant ministers in Europe when he was there on a mission, in which they had accused the Mormons of practicing polygamy. And this was in 1850, before the practice was generally made known by Brigham Young and Orson Pratt in 1852. This discussion had taken place in 1850. And these Protestant ministers had accused the Mormons of practicing polygamy. And John Taylor was quite indignant, if you read the transcript of...
Is that tract available now?
Yeah, so it's online. Yeah, it's called Three Nights Discussion.
Okay.
And you can Google that, and John Taylor and Three Nights Discussion, in which he was quite indignant that the church should be accused of such a vile and obscene and despicable practice. And when I read that in among my grandfather's papers, I thought, oh, wait a minute. John Taylor was practicing polygamy himself in 1850, as were most of the Mormon leaders, secretly, of course, but they were practicing it. And how can he be lying? And so he was being deceptive. Now, I understand the Mormon rationalization for lying about polygamy at that time, and also for their continual lying about it, even after they made it public, lying to protect their polygamous fathers and brothers from being arrested for cohabitation in Utah. And I understand the rationale for that, but it did bother me that an apostle of God would be lying when lying is so clearly condemned in the scriptures. I mean, the devil is the father of all lies, according to the scriptures.
I found this online, and I'm just going to read it. Uh-huh. This is John Taylor. I don't know if this is a primary source. Is this something published by the church?
Is this someone's recounting
of what they heard?
It was published by the church, and there are photocopies of the publication available. So the version you found online probably is reliable.
Okay, so this isn't some anti-Mormon claiming that John Taylor said this. This is
Okay,
and here's what
I read this among my grandfather's papers, who had it with him when he was on his mission.
Okay, and it says, "We are accused here of polygamy and actions the most indelicate, obscene, and disgusting, such that none but a corrupt and depraved heart could have contrived. These things are too outrageous to admit of belief." These things are too outrageous to admit of belief. Okay, so anyway, keep going. I just wanted to include that.
Right. Another thing that really made me question was reading in church history. And this was in official church history. I'm not from anti-Mormons. I had never been, as you know, although I took church history in seminary and somewhat in some of the religion classes at BYU, I was never all that much interested in church history, because I figured that was all really more or less irrelevant. The important thing was that the gospel was here, and the important thing was the doctrine, not how we got it, or not the events that surrounded the coming forth of the doctrine. And so I had never been interested in church history. But it was historical questions that often were coming up in my discussions with non-Mormon friends. So I began studying church history, and then I discovered more and more puzzling things. For example, I hadn't really known much about the Kirtland Banking Society, the Kirtland Bank that failed in 1837. And yet reading about it, I discovered that, you know, it was established by the prophet Joseph Smith, and the Mormons of the day believed, either rightly or wrongly, that it was established by inspiration, and that it was God-directed, and the prophet was directing it, and yet it failed. And another example was when the prophet organized Zion's camp to go and march from Kirtland out to Missouri to rescue the Mormons, and he promised them that, you know, this would go out and rescue our brethren in Missouri, and yet Zion's camp was an utter failure. A lot of them died of cholera, and they ended up getting out there and were scattered, and of course the Mormon explanation for that, the official explanation, is, well, it was a test of the people's faith. And
not only that, but I remember Joseph saying something to the effect of they weren't faithful enough. The members of the Zion's camp didn't exercise enough faith.
Yeah. Which is, of course, an explanation for a lot of the failures of prophecies.
Right.
And then the United Order. I mean, the United Order revelation says that it is an everlasting covenant. I mean, and this will be the order for my people from now on. And yet, the Mormons tried to practice it several times in Kirtland and in Utah, and it never worked out. And so the question arises, how can all these things that are supposedly instructions of the church and how things should work and inspired, they're failures.
Right.
And so it makes you question, you know, is this church really led by God? And since then, of course, there have been other examples of the same thing. You know, the Navajo placement or the Negro,
Indian placement,
Indian, the Lamanite placement program.
Right.
That didn't work out either. And the hand carts, although the Mormons claim that it was a great success and a spiritual experience and so on. I just finished reading Devil's Gate, and the hand carts were essentially a failure and caused tremendous suffering for the people that were involved in them.
Right. So, so we could keep going and list a lot of instances where programs or prophecies failed. But did you at any point cultivate a sense of anger that either that what was being taught on Sunday or over the pulpit was inaccurate or deceptive?
Well, I don't think I recall ever being really angry enough that I'd want to go out and, you know, set fire to a church or hit the bishop or run down a couple of Mormon missionaries with the car. I never was that angry. I don't think I was hurt, and I was upset at the results with the loss of my family. But I'm not as angry. I don't think I was ever as angry as a lot of people.
Okay, let me ask it different. Did you conclude at any point that the church was not being upfront or candid with its history?
Yes, I concluded. That was one of the things that I concluded as soon as I realized the church wasn't true. This is one of the things that led me to realize that the church is lying. And why would the church... why would the Church of God really want to lie or need to lie?
Right, right. And just to summarize, it lied by claiming that it never practiced polygamy. What were the main lies that bothered you at the time? Because failed hand carts isn't a lie, right?
I'm not sure I understand what you're saying about the.
What
failed
were the
hand
lies? Hand what were some examples of church lying or cover-ups or deception about its history? What were the main ones that irked you at the time, if you remember?
At the time that led me to leave the church,
yeah.
Or since
yeah at the time you left.
Well, I think I've mentioned most of them.
Okay, so it was lying about polygamy at some point.
Well, Joseph Fielding Smith lying to me about Brigham Young.
Okay, right.
And the church lying about whether it ever taught that Adam was God.
Right. Okay. Okay. No, those are fine. So those are examples. So, okay. So, so you leave the church, and you end up feeling like it's a house of cards, like. The church is not honest about its history. It hides its history, and it just doesn't add up.
It's not what it claims to be.
It's not what it claims to be. And the only
just another man-made religion.
And the only way to make sense of all the confusing, difficult things is to conclude that it's not true, right?
Right.
And then everything makes perfect sense.
That's right.
Polygamy, the failed prophecies, the whatever. It all comes to make sense. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Stories. To comment on this episode or to provide feedback, please check us out at mormonstories.org. If you want to help keep Mormon Stories alive, please consider either making a financial contribution or spreading the word about this episode through your blog, Twitter account, Facebook page, family newsletter, or through your ward bulletin and ward newsletter. Just kidding about those last two. Music on this episode was provided by Clayton and Sky Pixton. Check them out at claytonpixton.com or skypixton.com. That's Sky with an E, SKYE, pixton.com. Thank you.